take your Bibles and to turn with me to 1 Corinthians, to the Epistle of the Corinthians, the first one, chapter 7, and verses 25 through 40. We're in chapter 7, verses 25 through 40, and our sermon title this morning is Unattached from this Fleeting World. Unattached from this Fleeting World. And our sermon series, Called to be Saints, as we're continuing to walk verse by verse through the book of 1 Corinthians. Beginning in verse 25 through verse 40, the text reads, "Now concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think that in view of the present distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. This is what I mean, brothers. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no goods, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. For the present form of this world is passing away. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife. And his interests are divided. The unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly toward his betrothed, if his passions are strong, and it has to be, let him do as he wishes. Let them marry. It is no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, but having his desire under control, and has determined this in his heart, to keep her as his betrothed, he will do well. So then he who marries his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do even better. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. Yet in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as she is. And I think that I too have the Spirit of God." I thought personally in reading this passage and studying this week and for a variety of other reasons just how much the Lord has blessed me personally through my marriage with Laurie. I could take out a piece of paper and write down reason after reason, benefit after benefit that I've gained by my relationship with her. And I could do, not just for me personally and individually through marriage, but I could stand on solid biblical grounds and talk about the blessing of the institution of marriage to two people, and that God Himself holds a very high view of marriage, and that God Himself created marriage, and He created the man and the woman, and thought that it was not good for the man to be alone, but to have this connection, to have this union of two people in one flesh. I could stand with Ephesians and talk about how marriage done rightly and properly and lived out properly is a picture of the gospel of Christ and the relationship that Christ has with His church, and how the man is a picture of this sort of self-sacrificing, sanctifying, protecting and providing work of love and nourishment to his wife, Christ being to the church, and then secondly, the wife's submission and obedience to her husband voluntarily is like the church's submission to Christ, her head and her Lord. And so we could talk about these blessings. And so knowing that, knowing what I know personally about how I've been blessed and benefited by marriage, and how marriage is kind of the typical normative expectation for people in this world, and knowing how the high view and benefit of marriage that the Bible then talks about, it's kind of strange, isn't it, when we come to 1 Corinthians 7, chapter 7, and we hear Paul giving some arguments for reasons not to marry. It's almost odd to our ears and strange. And there are certainly, as you know well, been abuses and misunderstandings and misinterpretations of a passage like this. You had early on in the church men who would try to live completely celibate, ascetic lives, taking vows of celibacy, moving off into the desert, living as hermits and monks, you know, sitting on a pole by themselves in the desert sort of stuff. And that they thought this complete disassociation and detachment from the world somehow made them more holy. And as a result of that, there were people who looked at that those that were living out in the desert, living these ascetic lives, and they might say, why doesn't my local bishop or my local priest, my local pastor, if you will, why isn't he living like that? So as a result, there were then this requirement that grew into the early Catholic Church that priests must take these vows of celibacy and not marry, and that somehow this was a higher level of spirituality and superiority. And there was not just men who were priests that did this, but young women, young virgins, who also could consent to, let's say, marry the church and become what we know as nuns. And that this was somehow seen as a higher level of spirituality, superior to that of marriage. And that's an abuse of the passage that we see before us. But having said that, I think that there, while this sounds strange, this passage to us, there are some arguments that Paul makes in this passage that we desperately need to hear. Some arguments that Paul makes in here about the kind of attitude that we should have towards the world and towards our relationships and towards things that we desperately need to understand and to seek to strive toward. So I first of all want you to see Paul's attitude towards the Corinthian Christians, towards the church there in Corinth. Paul's attitude toward them. And I'm looking at the very first and last verse of our passage when I say this. Verse 25, he says, now concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. And then in verse 40, he says, yet in my judgment she is happier if she remains as she is, and I think that I too have the Spirit of God. First of all, what I want you to see is that Paul is writing to Corinth about things that they have asked him. He is giving his judgment. He's giving his opinion. He's giving pastoral counsel and advice about the situation that they have asked about. Here are, I believe, fathers and those who are fathers of those who are arranged marriages with other people. Not only that, that there are those who are in these arranged or betrothed sort of high engagements, if you will, and they're wondering, given Paul's sort of calling to remain as you are, should we go ahead and get married? Should we not get married? What's your advice? What's your counsel? What's your command on this, Paul? And so Paul is, first of all, answering things that he's been asked about. The second thing you need to see with regard to what Paul is doing is he says, I'm not giving you a command from the Lord. I don't have any statement from Jesus on this matter. I love that Paul is saying, he's unwilling to make up a saying of Jesus. He's unwilling to, when there's nothing that he knows of that Jesus has said, to just make one up. And though he doesn't have a command from Jesus on the matter, he is speaking in an inspired way, in an authoritative way, in an apostolic way. He says, I too, in verse 40, have the Spirit of God. I'm inspired by God. And not only that, he says, he gives his judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. He's been given and shown mercy. He's been called graciously by the Lord into this apostleship to the Gentiles. He's been given this task, this leadership responsibility from the Lord. And he's been proven trustworthy to the praise and glory of God as a result. But what he's doing here is not giving a command, but he's giving counsel. He's not saying this is what you have to do. He's saying this is my advice in the situation. So that's Paul's attitude. It's pastoral counsel. It's not a command. It's apostolic advice that we are getting here. This really is a suggestion in this case and not an imperative, not an absolute command. Second of all, what I want you to see is not only Paul's attitude towards the church, that he's very pastoral in his counsel here, but secondly, I want you to see the addressees that he has in the church. Who's he talking to? And we see in verse 25, now concerning the betrothed. Betrothal in that day is like unto our idea of engagement. But it's stronger than that. There was a relationship that was between the man and the woman, but it took a certificate of divorce to separate that relationship. Once you got betrothed, you couldn't break it off without a certificate of divorce. So it's stronger than our engagement. For us, until you go and actually stand before the preacher and say the vows, you know, you can break it off at any moment with sort of no penalty. But for them, even though there was no sexual relationship during betrothal, no living together during betrothal, there was a commitment, usually of a year's time period, that they couldn't separate without some sort of certificate. So that's who he's talking to. These people who's usually, in this case and in that situation, their fathers were involved. The fathers were arranging this and were talking with one another, and there was an exchange of goods and gifts, and so the at this point, until the young man and the young woman went and formed their own family, they were under their father's authority in that situation. They were under their parents' counsel, and so there was parents involved in this. And so he's speaking to these young people that are betrothed. They're tied to one another. They're not quite married yet, but they're already bound to one another. It's been arranged. It's been set in stone, and they're wondering, what should we do? You've counseled us to sort of remain in our calling, where our calling is betrothal, which usually is only temporary. What should we do? Should we back off from marriage, or should we go ahead and get married? What would you have us to do? So that's who he's talking to, these betrothed, first of all. We'll talk more about that in a second. The second thing, in verses 36 through 38, I think he's specifically talking to the fathers of these people that are betrothed. Now, the ESV does not make it sound like that. The way they interpret it, they're still talking to mostly the man in the relationship, the fiancé, as we might say, the male fiancé, if he's not behaving properly toward his betrothed. But I think, given the language and talking about giving in marriage, the fathers, often in this case, had some authority. And he's giving advice to the fathers about what they should do. Should he let his daughter, in this case, go ahead and get married, or should he not? What should he do? What's the counsel there? Should he give them in marriage? If she's unhappy and she wants to get married, how should he act? What's the counsel of Paul in the situation? And then lastly, in verses 39 through 40, he's talking to widows specifically, to women who are married. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, and then if her husband dies or she's widowed, she's free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. So she is marriage lasts a lifetime, but at death the marriage bond is broken and she's able to remarry. She's able to remarry whoever she wishes as long as she's a Christian. She's a Christian. She's able to marry in the Lord. So those are kind of the three sort of groups that Paul is addressing here. So having seen Paul's attitude and who Paul addresses, let's look at the application. What is the specific advice? What is the specific counsel that he gives? And we need to remember this as I say this. These are not commands. This is counsel. This is advice. And the first piece of advice we see in verses 26 and 27 is to remain as you're called. We looked at this last week. We looked at this 2 weeks ago. This has been Paul's consistent thing, that he's the status with which you're called, you ought to remain there unless there's some reason to change. So he's saying to remain as you call. Look, verse 26. I think that in view of the present distress, it's good for a person to remain as he is. So he gives an example specifically in verse 27. Are you bound to a wife? So are you in one of these betrothals? Not just are you married, but are you in one of these betrothals? He said, do not seek to be free. So don't divorce her. You remember as Joseph was going to do with Mary when he found out that she was with child, what he thought by another man, he was intending to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away. He's saying here, don't break it off. But he says, if you aren't a part of one of these betrothals, are you free from a wife? Don't seek one. Do not seek one. You don't have to be. Remain as you are. That's what he's saying. The other thing that he says is this. The other piece of advice is to marry if you want to or need to. If you want to get married or you need to get married, get married. That's his other piece of advice. Notice what he says in verse 28. But if you do marry, you've not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. He says it twice there. You haven't sinned by getting married. Now, that sounds odd to us that, you know, just that anybody would even have to say that. That you haven't sinned by getting married. But he's saying here, you've not sinned by getting... If you need to get married, want to get married, get married. Look at verse 36. It says something similar. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly toward his betrothed, if his passions are strong, and it has to be, let him do as he wishes. Let them marry. It is no sin. So he's saying to the fathers, let them get married. It's not a sin for you to let them get married. they want to get married, if she's of age, and he's a Christian and she's a Christian, they desire to get married, she's going to be unhappy if she doesn't get married, there's a risk of sexual immorality if this doesn't happen, let them get married. It's not sinful. Notice what he's going to end up saying here. His arguments are going to be that marriage is a gift from God, that singleness is a specific gift from God also. We've already seen that a couple of weeks ago. But not only that, but he says that as a result of this, I'm not saying, he says, that if you're single and celibate and unmarried, that you're holier than the married person. That's not what he's saying. He's not saying that that relationship is holier than the other. He's equally not saying that the marriage relationship is somehow holier than the single relationship. What he is saying is that it's best and expedient at that time. That it made sense. That there, he was trying to spare them some things. So having talked about Paul's attitude and the addressees and the application specifically, now let me give you Paul's argument. And here's where I want us to kind of focus and to hear what he's trying to say, because what has been foreign about this passage to us is where we really need to hear, whether we're married or single, maybe we're not dealing with this issue of whether or not to go ahead and get married or not. Probably most of us are not dealing with that sort of issue. But what we are needing to hear is Paul's argument. So the first thing that he says is, a person might consider not getting married, firstly, because of the present distress and worldly trouble that comes with getting married. Because of the present distress that we live in and the worldly trouble that comes from getting married. Look at verses 26 through 28. He says, I think that in view of the present distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. Now that begs the question for us. What is the present distress that he's talking about? What is the specifics here? Because persecution has not really been a theme of 1 Corinthians up to this point. Haven't really been talking about any sort of persecution that has come upon the church. What is this present distress? Whatever it is happening in Corinth and maybe in the Roman Empire entirely, they knew and understood. There are some who have said, well, you need to understand that about this time that there were severe floodings in Egypt. And when the Nile flooded and ruined some of the grain crop, that provided grain for the entire Roman Empire. And so there was a famine throughout Corinth and Rome and the Roman Empire. And it was hard to get food. It's hard to get bread. The prices of food had driven up. So that might have been some of the present distress. It wouldn't be a few years later before Emperor Claudius is going to say that they needed to start worshiping the emperor specifically in Corinth. And so this kind of emperor cult is going to grow up, and there's going to be persecution that comes about. The point is, we don't really know what the present distress is. They probably knew, but they don't. But more than that, here's what I want you to hear. Is that we live in the day and age between when Christ came and when Christ is coming again. And Jesus told us that during that time, which is called the last days, there's going to be tribulation. There is a present distress. Sometimes it's greater, sometimes it's lesser. But that we live in troubled times. And that we will continue to live in troubled times. And we need to give thought to that, especially if the times are especially troubled. Just think about those that lived in some of the major cities in the Great Depression. I know some of you lived through the Great Depression, and you were poor before it and you were poor during it and you didn't really know there was a depression. But some of the cities definitely did, and they had to farm out their kids and all sorts of things that were happening. It was a difficult time. And a difficult time. And what's been said, whether it's persecution or tribulation that Jesus has promised that we'd have, is that we as men may be heroes on our own and in our own mind, but as J.B. Lightfoot says, he says, a hero can turn a coward very quickly when he starts thinking about his widowed wife and his orphaned children. When we've got other responsibilities upon our mind to think about. And so it's one thing to go through this kind of present distress, to be, let's say, without work, or to be hard to put food on the table when it's you that's starving. It's much more difficult when you're having to watch your wife and children starve along with you or be persecuted along with you. I may be willing to die for Christ and be martyred. It's much different if they're threatening to kill my kids. So we understand what he's saying here. In view of the present distress on the situation, you might need to consider these things. And so what we need to hear is that we live in a time where we should expect tribulation, where we should expect suffering. And to be a Christian in any time is to mean there is going to be some suffering and some distress that comes upon us as a result of marriage. It adds to that worldly troubles. That's what it says in verse 28. If you do marry, you've not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles. There's present distress and you're going to have troubles if you marry. There's going to be times when things happen. And it's hard. It's difficult. And you have to worry about those things and be anxious about it. And he said, I would spare you that. So the second argument he makes then is that a person might consider not getting married because the time is short and this world is passing. Because the time is short and the world is passing. Look at verse 29. This is what I mean, brothers. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, those who mourn as though they were not mourning, those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no goods. And let those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it, for the present form of this world is passing away. Again, that begs the question, the appointed time for what is short? What exactly are we talking about, the appointed time is short? Because this was written in 51 or 50 A.D., and so we're asked, here we are 1900 and, 60 years later. We're asking, what's short about this time? What are we talking about? And some have said, well, maybe it's the time period of this distress. Maybe it's being shortened. Maybe that's what he's talking about. Maybe the distress is coming upon us more rapidly and is shortened. Or maybe he's just talking about that the return of Jesus Christ and the end of the world is imminent. It's impending. It's the next major thing that we're looking for. Yes, the man of lawlessness has to appear. Yes, there will be a mass conversion of Jewish people. But the next thing really on the radar is the return of Jesus. And He's going to come like a thief in the night. And we don't know when the time is coming. And we need to be prepared if it's a long time. And we need to be ready if it's tomorrow. And so the time is very short. And I think that's really what he's talking about, because he links this idea of the time being short to this world passing away. The present form of this world ending. There's going to be a new heavens and a new earth. What he's saying is this. Christians are a part of the kingdom of God. We live in the kingdom of this world, but we're citizens of the kingdom of heaven. And we're living in this world, but we're not of this world. And so we have to live as members and citizens, really, of two different kingdoms on this time. And what he's saying is that this whole idea of buying and selling, of rejoicing and crying, and the idea of marriage and remarriage and singleness, it's passing away with this kingdom. And we as Christians are to be future-oriented, thinking about what is to come, laying up treasures, not here, but there. Laying up treasures and being focused not on this earthly, temporal world, but on the heavenly one. So that's why he's saying we need to consider this idea of not being married, because it helps us to realize that our lives are to be in this future kingdom and to be building and laying up treasures in this future kingdom. My relationship with my wife, as wonderful as it is in the present, is not eternal. In heaven, there is no marriage nor giving in marriage. It's passing away. The whole concept is passing away. This idea of buying and selling. We need material goods. You won't take a single thing with you, though, in the end. So live with the things that you have now. Hold on to them very lightly. You do not know when the Lord might take your life, or the life of your wives, or the life of your children. Hold on to these things lightly. Don't make idols out of them. They're good gifts, precious blessings. But our future is not here, and we're not building heaven here. Our future is there. And we need to seek that and think about that and consider that. So do things in this lifetime that have eternal significance, that have eternal value. That's what he's calling us to. And then thirdly, he says a person might consider not getting married because his devotion and duties are naturally divided. Verses 32 to 35. I want you to be free from anxieties. What kind of anxieties? What kind of worries might we have? What kind of anxiety might we have? He said, the unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. That's what his focus is able to be on. Notice first of all, he's not saying that the single man the single Christian man should live for himself and just please himself. He's expecting, if you're remaining single and unmarried as a Christian, then you're seeking to please someone, but not yourself and not your spouse because you don't have one, but to please the Lord, to live for the Lord, to do things for the Lord. That's his expectation. It's not to stay single, to be selfish. He's saying you're considering how you might best please the Lord, and that's your sole focus. But he says the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife. You know, happy wife, happy life sort of idea, what he's saying. He's hoping that you might consider how to please her, how to put food on the table, how to provide, how to love. So understand something. By nurturing, loving, caring for your wife and children and your family, by working hard for them, by protecting them, you're pleasing the Lord. That he's not saying you're not pleasing the Lord in doing those things. He's just saying you've got responsibilities when you get married. And some of those responsibilities and those duties that the Lord has commanded and that the Lord expects of you, divide your attention and divide your devotion. And you have to give time to them. You have to. You can't. You have to go to work and you have to do these things. And the Lord would have you do that. He says the same thing with regard to women. The unmarried or betrothed woman, in verse 34, is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. As she should be. The Lord wants her to be. The Lord's not disgusted when she takes care of her husband and family and seeks to please him. He wants that to happen. But he's just saying that their devotion is naturally divided. That it has to be. And that there's anxiety and concern, not just for yourself, and not just for what the Lord would have you do, but what the Lord would have you as a family to do. You have other people to consider. Other people to think about. So having talked about all these things, let's look then at Paul's aims in the church. Paul's aims. And the first, he says all of this why? Verse 28, to spare them trouble. To spare them trouble. This is his pastoral desire. He's trying to spare them trouble. Why would a pastor say hard things to you? Why would a pastor say things to you that you don't want to hear? Maybe he's trying to spare you some trouble. Maybe he's trying to spare you some heartache. What else is he trying to do? Look at verse 32. He's trying to free them from anxiety. I want you to be free from anxieties, he says. He's just saying, get this, married folks. Married life is hard. It's stressful. There's trouble there. It's two sinners trying to live with one another. And when you start adding kids, then you get more sinners involved. It's difficult. And there's stress. And I know some of you that are single are saying, yeah, I've got this stress-free life because I'm not married. I know you're probably saying that. Like, I'm free from anxiety. I don't have anything because I'm not married. That's not what he's saying. He knows very well that you have other responsibilities, and they may be other worldly cares. That maybe you're taking care of parents or other people. Maybe you have other things that you have to consider as well as an unmarried person, that you have some of these divided loyalties that you have to give time to. But he's saying to free them from anxiety. Notice in verse 35, to benefit them, not to burden them. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you. That's why he's saying, I'm not commanding you not to get married. If you want to get married, you think it's a good idea, go ahead and get married. It's not sinning. You're not being unholy. You're not being unfaithful to the Lord. The Lord's not looking on you and shaking his head. He's not disappointed with you whatsoever. He's happy to you. Marriage is a good thing. Marriage is a blessing. He's created you and created marriage. Go ahead and get married, what he's saying. But he's saying this for their benefit. To be a blessing to them. Not to burden them. Not to restrain them. So he's saying, I'm not saying this in order to put a noose around your neck. I'm not saying this in order to ensnare you or to trick you into something. This is what's so silly about those who would early on make vows of celibacy and other things in their lives and then get to this situation where it becomes hard and even impossible and they're trapped in this sort of situation where they feel like they're dishonoring the Lord if they go back on that. He says, I'm not trying to trap you, ensnare you. But he's promoting devotion to the Lord. Look at verse 35 again. I'm doing this but to promote good order, to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. We naturally, if we're married, have divided devotion. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's what the Lord calls us to. But there is an undivided devotion that the Lord may have for those that He gifts with singleness. He's doing this to curb sin in verse 36. One of His aims. But He says, if His passions are strong, and it has to be, let them do as He wishes. Let them marry. It's no sin. He's not trying to say this because He says marriage or anything like that is sinful. He's saying here that if you get in a situation where, you know, you're passionate about someone and you're at risk of committing sexual immorality, fornication in some way, marry, get married. He's not doing this in order to keep you from some sin. He's trying to curb sin, not promote it. And then to give them the best, verse 38, a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. No, verse 38, so when he marries, his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do even better. So if marriage is good, and he's saying, but abstaining is maybe even better. Here's what I love about what we see here, and it's this. What I love is that it is cultish to have hard and fast rules for everyone. But Paul, in his apostolic authority, is talking about things that are better and things that are best, and realizing that God has different callings for different people, and there's not a one-size-fits-all sort of Christianity. That's what I'm seeing here that I like very well. If God calls you to get married as he called me to do, and it was a blessing, then get married. If God calls you to be single and you can do that faithfully and without sin, then do that, and it will be a great blessing to you. It's not a disgrace not to get married, as some would have thought in that day. It's not a stigma not to get married, as some would have thought in that day. It's a good thing to do. It's not morally superior, but it's expedient. It's beneficial to them, and even to the church and through the kingdom of God, that they're able to do that. Paul wouldn't have been able to do the missionary journeys that he was able to do if he had a wife and kids that he had to leave all the time or drag around with him. He just couldn't have done that. And then lastly, what we see is to make them happy. To make them happy. Yet in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as she is. And I think that I too have the Spirit of God. So he believes that there's happiness here. There's joy. There's blessedness here. So consider that is all he's saying. Again, this is a passage that kind of sounds strange to our ears in many ways. But when we look deeper and delve at some of the assumptions that Paul makes, some of the arguments that he considers, we realize we need to hold on more loosely to the things in our life, even the good things in our life, our houses and our possessions, our money. We need to be generous with that. With our relationships, we recognize, listen, if you're of a certain age at all, you've recognized that sin and death has affected your life. People that you have loved, your parents, maybe even your children, your spouse, they've died. Your family does not look now as it once did. And so death and sin and the results of sin have destroyed what you once knew. And you wake up with that reality. And you can look at someone else's life and be jealous of that and be dissatisfied with who you are and what God has given to you and what your situation is. But He's called us to be content with our calling, to be content in Christ to remain as we are, if at all possible, and to do so in a way that's holy and happy and beneficial to us. Let's go to the Lord in prayer.